for me, remembering the Rats of Tobruk, they're not just the Rats of Tobruk, they're actually ordinary men of Mackay who could be someone's grandfather, their great uncle. So there's that sort of familiar attachment to it because I see them as my ancestors, a more direct linkage to that. That's why I think it's so important, because the Siege of Tobruk was 72 years ago and the living rats today are all in their late 90s. Very soon we're going to lose not just the rats but that generation, and they're probably the greatest generation that we've ever had. You've got to remember, when they were young, their parents went off to the First World War and then they were involved in the Second World War. And it's easy to forget that what we have today in Australia, the democracy, the way we have the peace, the way we make multiculturalism work, our general wealth, it just didn't happen by accident. It happened because of the generations that came before. And it's too easy to forget that in the comfort that we have, that we inherit it from those who put in blood, sweat and tears to achieve it.
I was wounded in action. My first encounter with an enemy, I got a flesh wound in my shoulder, which unfortunately got infected. Because of that, I was a marked man being sent to a convalescent camp. Because I didn't want to lose the association with my battalion, believe it or not, when you're inactive skirmishing in wartime, you forge bonds of friendship and you become like you're a member of a family. I was determined that I wouldn't leave my family. Some of my close friends, before we went into action the first time, had missed out on it because of being in con camp, so I was trying to avoid it. So I stowed away with a friend named Franklin. When we were skirting the outskirts of Bardia, which is sort of on the way from Egypt to Tobruk, there are two ports. My driver, Mr. Franklin, managed to put a wheel over the edge of a steep escarpment, and we did several somersaults down to the bottom of a wadi. He spent the night there. My shoulder was killing me where it had been stood on while we were somersaulting. The truck wasn't in great shape, but it looked drivable. In the early hours of the morning, a huge Thornikov truck heaved in sight and it pulled up on us, saw us boiling a billy for our breakfast. In return for half a case of tinned peaches, the stuff that we were carrying was all intended for the officer's mess. Anyway, we managed to get him to use his big winch and wound us up, and then we all played around with it and got some more oil into it because it all leaked out and it was lying on its side. We eventually made it to Tobruk. They had to pull up the barbed wire, which was across the road, so that we could get in. And we were probably the last vehicle to reach Tobruk, travelling along the what was called the Bardia Road.
People have basically forgotten that you have to work together. The people you live with are the people that you are loyal to, not outside governments or anything else like that. It's the people that you pass every day in the streets, that you work with, that are your families, your next door neighbours. They are the people you give your loyalty to, and they're the ones that you work with, and they're the ones that you help. And I think with the rats, especially, because they were by themselves, they were in a desert, they were surrounded, they were outnumbered, they were bombed every day, they didn't have water for a shower, they lacked water. It was 8 months of constant battle. And the Australians were the main infantry group there, 14,000, but they relied upon the British artillery to protect them from the diving bombers.
Tobruk was a fortress the Italians had built, and there were sub-fortresses within the main fortress. the place that commanded militarily, commanded the whole caboodle, was called Pilastrina. It was a small knoll, really, but it sort of slopes swept up to it, and it was an obvious place to have a fallback position when you're under heavy attack. It was manned by my battalion at this particular time, and I'd been transferred from B Company to the carrier platoon, of all things. I was a junior thing around the place with the least experience, all the rest, so they gave me the job of battalion runner. There were no such things as portable radios or anything like that those days. Our engineers had their headquarters too in a building on the top of this crest. I was doing my runner's duty when there's a bit of a lot of aircraft noise. We look up and I see these Stukas coming. They're the German dive bombers. They're the ones that make people get very frightened. See, because they open up with twin machine guns and take their line from that, and then they drop showers of anti-personnel bombs. We thought they were on their way to, as they did every day, to bomb the harbour, because that was our strong point, way of communicating with bigger forces. So we get a shock when the first one, there were 37 of them, and the first one just led down to show the others where to go, throw a marker down, and if possible get something that'll raise a lot of smoke. A fellow I knew, he and I were doing what was seemed very logical. We made a dash for one little half-built foxhole. The term foxhole hadn't been got then, but that's what it was. He yelled out to me when he saw I was running for it too. He said, "Come on, Al, there's room enough for two." And I knew there wasn't room enough for two. So I just propped where I was and went down. And he got himself an anti-personnel bomb that went right through his body and exploded underneath him. All I got covered in showers of rock like you'd build a road with. The only hurt I had out of it was revulsion, because I was trying to get the dust out of me, and I pulled my right arm across my mouth, and what part of it was a part of my friend, I don't know, but I couldn't get the taste out of my mouth. It didn't matter what I did.
When you have people come up who've been, you know, in Vietnam now, they're the youngest ones really, except for the Afghanistan and Iraq, of course, the children latch in quite well, because here's somebody who was actually there, and you do it by telling a story. Like all stories, all history, you know, oral history is passed down through stories, and by making it a personal story. So you're not actually talking about campaigns and things like that. You're talking about my grandfather or my father was there. And if you have something like a photograph, a medal, a uniform, you make that emotional connection with them. And they immediately latch right into the storytelling, and they can make an emotional response to it. That's what they really need to do, because many of them don't get to see their grandparents. They're sort of removed from thinking about, oh, the ones that came before us, the thing.
A lad came who served us with beer. He started talking to us, and it turned out his father was in the engineers, and he'd got him to claim him. You could do this in wartime. He was only 18. He said he was waiting. He said his next move was up to his dad. He'd got this far, and they'd given him slushy duties to do. And just then, in comes a flight of German Dorniers dropping their big bombs as accurately as they could. The windows of this stone building, they've built a big blocks of sandstone that comes into this little story. They had heavy beams of timber put across the windows in them, And this young bloke had just brought us our beer on a tray. And the sirens go and the bombs come down. And he's still standing there. He'd been talking to us about his father. Everybody else in the place dived on the ground. The sergeant, he couldn't dive on the ground because he had this rank, this decoration. He had to provide an example. I couldn't dive on the ground. The young bloke, instead of diving on the ground, he saw our example, so he just stood there holding the ground. The next thing, what I see is part of the shell casing of a German bomb sticking out of his forehead. We couldn't save him or do anything with it. We took him outside and helped him die. That's all we could do for him. I went back to the ward where I should have been, and I've got a big block of sandstone in my bed. People would have difficulty in believing what I'm telling you. So help me God, that's exactly what happened.
Alan, because he actually is a Radicher Brook, and he's actually someone who was there, and they can actually see him and they can actually go over and talk to him. We sort of encourage the students to thank the veterans, not just here but in Anzac Day, because that simple thing means so much, that someone actually remembered what they did. It wouldn't just be Radicher Brook, it would be Iraq, and also it would be Afghanistan as well. Just say, well, thank you. Because whatever the political reasons, these Australians' main purpose is to protect us. And that's why they join, for their country.
As a war, it was a pause of some sort in the world's development to the destruction that should probably eventually fall before us. We're talking at the moment about, will they loose the bomb or will they not? We can't stand too many of them.
Even though they knew Tobruk was important, they didn't realise it was basically the first victory of the war, you could say it was the beginning of the end, really. It was a turning point. Before that, the Germans had all Europe. They were unstoppable. Nobody was stopping them at all. And the Americans weren't in the war by then either, so they weren't there. So by just that outpost at Tobruk for 8 months held them up, that changed the world. And basically started the future that we have today.